How Chuck the Prophet Got His Groove Back, written and read by Tripoli. When the angel finally leaves him alone and the vertigo from his latest story bomb has receded into regular hangover shakes, Chuck goes out on the front porch and smokes 3 cigarettes and gets on the phone with Janelle. "What the fuck?" he tells her without saying hello. "This fucking sucks. I don't even get to be a cruel, capricious god anymore. Now I'm the cruel, capricious god's pet accordion monkey. I'm a pet Shakespeare monkey, only not even. I'm like the monkey who produces the complete works of Stephen King's Bachman era." He hears Janelle swallow something quickly, and there's noise and some music in the background. "Okay, honey, keep talking. My editor's here. I'm going to put you on speaker." There's some muffled noise. "Kathy says you should quit while you're still a primate." Chuck closes his eyes and counts most of the way back from 3. "Hey, Kathy, tell Janelle I'm freaking the fuck out and she's getting a raise for being an awesome friend and not hanging up on me even though I'm calling when she's supposed to be doing work or whatever." The speakerphone clicks off. "Chuck, are you being serious? What's wrong?" In the novel Chuck constantly narrates in his head, he's the man-child makes good POV character, and Janelle is the obnoxious funny ballbuster who rolls in from her stint as a sex therapist in Australia or bodyguard to the stars when a subplot is stalling out. Janelle is a great person for a novelist to be friends with because she's cooler than most of them are and easy to live through vicariously. She reads everything he writes, so he can't be too obvious about it, but in his mind, he put half of her personality into Ellen Harvell and half into Bella Talbot, and the only time he's ever cried from his own writing is when he got to the end of Dream a Little Dream of Me and realized why Bella needed the cult so bad. Only apparently, he didn't. Apparently, Ellen Harvell and Bella Talbot are actual people neither he nor Janelle have ever met, and Bella was actually mauled to death and is being tortured in a literal biblical hell right now for protecting herself in the only way a traumatized 14-year-old thought she could, and Janelle, right now, is shouldering her way out of some swanky network cocktail party in New York City to talk crazy wino hermit Chuck down off the ledge again. "Chuck, come on, are you still there?" she asks. Maybe he asks again. He was just hearing her voice for a few seconds there, pleasant bubbling noise. "Are you okay? Did you take something?" That's not a bad idea, but no. It's easy to get Janelle on her BlackBerry, but between her being busy and him being even more of a hermit than usual lately, this is the first time he's heard her voice in weeks. "I thought the New York thing was next week. Today's the 18th, right?" "The New York thing is next week, but I'm not going anymore. This is a different New York thing." "What do you mean you're Stephen King's pet monkey? Did your publisher call?" Chuck is a really terrible person for a professional sports writer to be friends with. For one thing, he sincerely could not care less about sports. He doesn't even know anything about sports unless Janelle's personally written about it. For another, Janelle has been a professional sports writer since Boston's NBC affiliate hired her straight out of grad school, while Chuck has been a fuck-up more or less since birth and has written 78 cult novels in 3.5 years because he stopped leaving the house. He wasn't even a novelist when he met her. He was supporting himself writing ad copy for a company that sold stereo equipment by industry catalog and spending his free time storyboarding a graphic novel history of the firebombing of Tokyo that has lurked unfinished on his last 3 computers. He keeps hoping that the next hard drive meltdown will be the one to take 7 thunders off his conscience for good, but at least if the apocalypse happens next week, he won't have to worry that he missed his best chance at literary immortality. Chuck has no idea why Janelle even picks up the phone for him, except that she likes his notes better than most of her real editors, and she likes him for some reason he doesn't understand, and maybe because she thinks he's a decent guy, but only really deep down. "No, Jesus, nothing like that," he says. "Hey, speaking of which, is Jesus there yet?" "I don't know, Matt. I just walked in. I think I saw his agent." Janelle has the kind of facial expressions that you can hear over the phone, or maybe just Chuck hears them. Right now, she's got her eyes closed and her forehead scrunched up, maybe waving to someone at the party she knows, maybe gesturing that Kathy doesn't need to call 911. Jesus is Chuck's name for Bill Kopis, the Seahawks running back who's unsuccessfully hit on Janelle at every big industry party since the Clinton administration. He's born again, but he doesn't make a big deal out of it. He's just Jesus in contrast to ex-Tom, who operates a funeral home in Framingham and has boundary issues. Janelle and Tom were mostly together right after he finished No Rest for the Wicked and the publisher canceled him, and by the time he was caught up and sober, Janelle had kicked ex-Tom out of the house, and Chuck rewarded him with a guest role as manipulative stalker rapist douchebag guy in Wishful Thinking. Except, oh right, no he didn't, because there's a real live Wes Mondale exerting gravitational force in 3-dimensional space somewhere, probably still lurking around poor Hope Casey down at Lucky Chin's, and Christ, Chuck probably needs to do something about that. Or maybe that's the kind of thing the apocalypse is for? Christ, these angels aren't good for anything. "Are you still there?" He tuned out again for a second. "Come on, I'm already late to this thing, tell me what's going on." He rubs the sleeve of his robe across an incipient ink in his forehead, which gets mistaken for a friendly wave by his asshole neighbor across the street, and he has to wave again to cancel that wave out, and the guy gives him that "I am mentally scripting my interview on the local news when you get busted for the bodies in your basement" look, and goes back to washing his flatbed. I don't know. Something kind of weird happened today, and it's freaking me out, but I can't talk about it yet. Okay, so don't. He hears her settle the phone on her shoulder so she can get a cigarette out of her purse. She needs one of those Bluetooth headsets like nobody he knows, and he says needs, but she doesn't wear the one he bought her for Christmas because she thinks non-crazy people yelling and flailing at thin air look like assholes. Can you tell me how kind of weird we're not talking about here? Chuck bites his lip and takes his time ashing his cigarette on the porch railing. He doesn't think an archangel would fly all the way to Manhattan to zap his best friend just for the hell of it, but Zachariah had been pretty specific about him keeping Heaven's latest ICBM of latent psychosis to himself, and he doesn't want to take that chance. She'll insist on hearing it eventually, but he hadn't planned on seeing her till her brother's wedding in September, assuming there are still such things as weddings by September, and he'll be able to make up a cover story by then. Extremely kind of. I'm still not positive I'm not hallucinating kind of. By the way, that shrink who said John is the product of a bad relationship with my parents is going to owe me some money back. Attaboy. She makes a sympathetic hmm noise and her lighter flicks. This is Edlin's stuff again? For a second, Chuck wants to tell her everything so badly it almost comes out against his will. The Angels and Lilith and Wes X Tom fucking Mondale and how Sam and Dean have a last name and he's known it for 4 years and never told anyone, not even her, just because Winchester always felt like the ace up his sleeve of an unknowable but conclusive suit, something he would know exactly how to play when the time came. Which just goes to prove his instincts for impending disaster are as traitorously shitty as he has always suspected them to be, and that get-out-of-a-dignified-and-merciful-death-free card probably isn't transferable to people you would just rather have alive than yourself. So apparently he's going to add lying to Janelle to the list of lousy things he's done this week, for no reason he clearly understands. Instead, he sticks the cigarette back in his mouth like a gag and mumbles, "I'm afraid so, Janet." She snorts a laugh without meaning to, and that is point one to Chuck. The first real conversation he'd ever had with Janelle was when some mutual friends flaked on a midnight showing of Rocky Horror and they decided to go by themselves. The Christmas he got her a Bluetooth and her fancy cheese stuff, for reasons known only to Janelle, she got her production department to send him an elaborately composed graphics package of Dr. Frankenfurter in various writerly poses around Chuck's house with Chuck's head stuck on, while Fabio and Freddie Prinze Jr. flex and lounge around the background in their underwear, offering helpful and deeply inappropriate suggestions via thought balloon. Chuck's not getting a lot of favors from God lately, but if Sam and Dean had seen that on his desktop wallpaper, he's pretty sure he actually would have had to find a way to kill himself. "It's not a big deal," he says. "Or it might be possibly. It was just really weird." "I'm okay, I promise. I just want to say hi. Sorry, go back to your thing. Call me back whenever." "Well, I'm out here now, so hi, you freaking fruitcake." She doesn't really sound all that annoyed, mostly because these network parties sound awful, even if you haven't been to 5,000 of them before. But the silence is agonizing anyway, waiting for her to hang up or joke it off or tell him to go to AA again. Half a second before he's about to pretend that pizza guy is at his door, she says, "I was going to email you anyway. I just found out I'm getting furloughed for 2 weeks before preseason. I was thinking of taking a drive up through Ontario. I could pick you up on my way out if you want to split gas." He stands up so fast, he almost whacks his head on the porch frame. "I'm an idiot." "What? Wait, say that again." "He's a fucking idiot." "What? Do you want to take a road trip with me through Ontario, or are you going to be busy having your nervous breakdown?" "Wait, preseason is August, right?" He had no idea why he was picking up the phone when he called her, except that he wanted to hear her voice, but now that she said it, it seems like the most brilliant idea anyone has ever had, and he can't believe he didn't think of it first. He's such a stupid fucking drunk. "Wait, what's in Ontario?" "Not Carver Edlin, what do you care?" She has a point. Or she would if this were still the semi-sane, not-about-to-end world Chuck had occupied yesterday. No, this is perfect. This is... not you getting furloughed, that sucks, but we need to do this as soon as humanly possible. Fly out here, we'll take my car." "That's not a car, it's the Steely Teutonic Death Carriage," she says, but she's not about to hang up anymore. One of the few reasons he doesn't feel that guilty about making her read all his books is that she's as obsessed by road trips as he is, but for totally opposite reasons. Since she grew up in the Bronx and never had a car till she was 26 and working 70 hours a week, she's never actually been on one, which is why she still believes that there is anything remotely obsession-worthy about them. Chuck has personally killed not one but two beater cars on cross-country drives, clearing out his dad's house after he died, and actually came up with most of the plot of the first Supernatural novel when he was pulled over for the night outside a Chinese restaurant in Topeka. Mostly because at the time, killing monsters and saving hot women had less in common with being trapped on an interstate 10 hours a day than almost anything he could think of, and he was down to either outlining mediocre horror novels in his head or plowing his 1986 Plymouth Satellite into an overpass. It's the exact kind of thing that's a miserable ordeal until you get your best friend involved, at which point it's an adventure. In this case, probably a Roland Emmerich adventure. None of that's mine anymore. The thought is there floating in front of him, not really fitting into any version of logic he knows, since of course it was never his to begin with, not the bad son guilt or the musical taste or Bobby's names for his dogs. He can tell it, but none of it was ever going to be of him but the words he picks out to give it form. I think they have parks or something. I don't know what she's saying. Mountains? Polar bears? Chuck closes his eyes. I guarantee you there are absolutely no polar bears in Ontario, Janelle. That's like 5,000 miles too far south, he tells her with conviction. Or north, whatever. They don't have too many native cheetahs left either. They have tons of fucking polar bears in Ontario. You can do a thing where you swim with them. Look it up, Magellan. There's a pause while she takes a drive. If you're busy, then don't worry about it. I'll go by myself, or I'll call Lena or somebody. He loves Janelle a lot for pretending there's any possibility of him being busy for 2 weeks at any given moment. No, I'm not busy. I just think it'll be better if we, you know, if we go sooner than that. I know a guy who is in no way a fictional character, so this better be for real, Zachariah. With a cabin on the U.S. side, way up in the mountains. Nobody's used it in months. On our way down, we can stop and just hang out. For 2 or 3 months, or until we're all raptured or eaten by hellhounds, or beamed up to the mothership, whichever comes first. Chuck's never done much with his POV, but enough to know that Bobby Singer has a ton of weird shit he's never told anyone about, not even Sam and Dean. Chuck's positive that cabin's stocked up well enough for whatever it is that's gonna happen. We'll just go earlier. Soon. What, you mean like Memorial Day weekend? He snorts and is a little afraid it comes out sounding more like a sob. I mean, like, get your coat on me, because I'm getting in my car to go to the airport as soon as I get off the phone, and your ass better be packed and ready to go when I get there. The hell you are, she says. I can't disappear for 2 weeks. I have a job. I'll get fired. Tell Kathy you want to take your furlough early, he says. Early, like, he checks his watch. 8 hours from now. You can do preseason research when you get back. What do they care? They're not going to pay you either way, so fuck them. No, not fuck them. They pay me the rest of the time. I'm in the middle of stuff here. I'm getting a byline Monday. Do they not have the internet between here and Ontario? Do it in the car. I'll help. We'll knock it out before we're out of Jersey. The New York thing is off. He pushes his door open and starts poking at his computer to wake it up. It can sense when he really desperately needs something from it and likes to take its time and dangle the threat of blue computer death in its face. What else? And our intern just started. He can't even find the bathrooms on his own yet. Tell him to squeeze his legs together, he says. Beside which, what are you doing following innocent, nubile college boys to the bathroom, you pervert? What else? She's silent for half a second too long, and he knows he's so in. What's wrong with August? Forget August. Tell me your grandfather died. No, tell them I died. I bludgeoned myself to death with the printer scanner. Can Kathy still see you? Start crying and telling me I have so much to live for. He gets up and waves at his neighbor through the window with gusto one more time, just to keep the little bastard on his toes. You're a genius. I fucking love you. Chuck, shut up for a second. If something's really wrong, you have to tell me, Janelle says. I'm not getting in a car with you for 2 weeks just so you can bullshit me and get wasted every night. But it's a nice perk, isn't it? He pulls up the first flight he can find to Logan and figures that if he makes all the lights and there's no line of security, he has almost 45 seconds to pack everything and get dressed. If the doors aren't locked, they aren't locked. Maybe when the roaches take over, they'll have a taste for serialized horror melodrama and Mad Dog. I'll tell you everything as soon as I can, I swear to God. Pack something warm. I'll be there soon. Is this a Salinger thing? You think his friends put up with this? It's some consolation that if Zachariah thinks he's going to throw down with Janelle Alamy, he's going to need a flaming sword, a ninja angel posse, and at least 2 days' notice. It's not a Salinger thing, he assures her. Then he snickers. Polar bears in Ontario. I'll trade your ass to those polar bears for gas money, you stupid dick. I can't believe I'm doing this. If Kathy says no, I'm out. We'll throw him in the trunk, he says, before he catches himself and remembers why he really, really doesn't want to think about women in trunks right now. I'll call before we take off, okay? Love you. She's silent for a second, startled, he thinks. You too. Have a safe trip. He tosses the phone somewhere and loses 10 seconds, deciding to bring a legal pad and some pens with him just in case, then changes his mind and drops it all in the middle of his kitchen floor, already pulling off his bathrobe. On his way out the door, he loses 10 more seconds finding out that he is actually wrong about the polar bears.